that were introduced in SQL 2012 and comparing that to what we had with multidimensional models in the previous versions of the product. And importantly, what I'm sort of trying to dwell on is what directions you should take. We'll spend a while having a look at what's different and how that might affect you, and try and give you some sort of advice on where I think you should probably head with this. So first up, where are we? So if you look at analysis services prior to this appearing, this is a mature product. It's been in the market a while now and well regarded in the market. Importantly, for people implementing it, we also have a good number of people who know how to use it. So this is important to people implementing projects. The tooling is regarded as really good. And so this has been another nice aspect of the Microsoft platform compared to many of the other platforms. The market position is in a pretty good state. And importantly, this is within organizations as well. And so what I've seen in a lot of the Gartner type reviews, they talk about how many organizations have implemented some sort of BI system, and then they look at what is the penetration of the BI system within the organizations for the people who have actually done this. And it's much higher in the Microsoft stack. And so the question is, why change anything, right? And so people look and go, well, why are you doing something different, and why would we even want to do that? Now, clearly, you want to maintain compatibility and you want to be able to reuse existing knowledge where you can, but there's a big push to try and expand the user base. So a lot of people get the multidimensional models, but there's a lot more people who don't get that terribly well. And in many cases, in some of the projects, the complexity of some of that isn't really needed. And so an awful lot of people understand tabular or table-based systems, and in many cases, that's enough for a lot of applications. And it's often much faster to build. And so what I want to talk about in this session is, look, why are we even doing this, right? Why are we looking at tabular models? I'll spend some time then having a look at what's different about it. And so if I'm implementing systems today in multidimensional, like, what is the difference I'm going to see if I'm doing this in tabular? Then we'll take a look at, like, what are the extra things I pick up when I use tabular? And importantly, what are the things that aren't going to be there if I do that? And finally, some advice on where I think you should head. And so the first thing is, look, why do we do this? Now, there is a big learning curve, or perceived to be, in the multidimensional models. I know one of the things, I'm in a company called SQL Down Under, we do a lot of BI training and a lot of BI consulting work. And when I look at the training we do in analysis services, all we can ever do is take somebody through the most common things that they would set in the product. Because there are so many things that you can configure in the product. If we did talk about all that, it would just be in one ear and out the other anyway. And it's only when you run into a situation where you need these things, then you suddenly go, ah, there is a thing in the product that does that. And that's a great thing. MDX as a language has been regarded as probably not trivial to learn. I have a number of friends. I would consider myself a dabbler in MDX. I've sort of done so a long time. But it's not something I spend my life in all day, every day. So I sort of feel like I dabble in it. I love particularly books that have recipes on, here's how you might do something. Friends here, like I think Grant and Glenn and probably Jeff, I don't know if Jeff's here this week. I mean, there's guys locally who do a lot more MDX than I tend to, and Peter Myers is around somewhere. And a lot of those guys are quite proficient at MDX. I have a few friends that I consider think in MDX. So these are guys like Chris Webb, Darren Gospel. But it's not a huge number of people that I think, you know, just really think that way. Another big one for analysis services is that the data today comes out of databases to go into the data model. Now, data's appearing in a whole lot of other places. So if I want to mash up things from data feeds or applications that are exposing services or picking up data out of reports or just simply calling commercial services, I'm typically having to do that in an ETL phase and do that in integration services or something and bring the data into a database first, and then I can build the model over that. Now, in many cases, that might be fine, but there's also a big push that says, can I just reach out and get some of that data? Performance is an issue. I think it's a tribute to the product how well it works with badly designed aggregations, right? I've lost count of the number of places I go into where they say they've got some performance problem, and you look and there are no aggregations. It's surprising how well it still works. But designing aggregations is an ongoing thing, and it's an ongoing task, and again, takes skill to do that. But the other big changes that are afoot are all around how we do overall design of computer systems per se. And mostly, it's the changes that have happened in compression. So look, lots of these things are important, but I think it's all about compression, where this is all heading. Now, if you look at SQL Server compression, we didn't have that in 2005 when that version of the product appeared. The product was getting beaten up in the data engine by some of the competitors that already had that in place. And if you look at an SAP system or something and you said, hey, bring your system across and implement it on SQL Server, and then if you said, oh, and by the way, you need to buy two or three times as much disk space, that isn't a great story, right? And so that needed to change. And they introduced var decimal at that point, where they just stored decimal values a bit smaller. Now, that got around a lot of problems in terms of the size of databases, and they realized this is important, and this is a journey they've been going on. 2008, they introduced row and page compression. I actually thought that was the best thing in the box in 2008, bar none. And yet it amazes me the number of sites I go into where people have the Enterprise Edition, but they're not using it. Every time I talk to them, they think that compression means smaller and slower, but the reality is it's smaller and faster, and it's a good story. Most SQL Server boxes are I/O bound today. That's changing. But most of the ones I go into are still I/O bound, and anything you do by changing what space a row takes that makes you have to do less I/O has a profound impact on the performance of the product. So if you cut the I/O to a half or a third of the size, the other thing is because the row formats have changed, in memory, you now fit two or three times as many rows in the same amount of memory. So your caches and things work better as well. And the trade-off, of course, was CPU. So the argument, now in most systems, there's plenty of CPU available. But even there, the argument is per page, it might be up 6 or 7% or something on the CPU. But the reality we found in bigger systems is the CPU goes down too. And it was counterintuitive to me why that would be. But of course, it's because a lot of the CPU is used for things like page handling, and we're now dealing with a smaller number of pages dramatically. So if you have a thing that makes your I/O a lot faster, makes your cache work a lot better, and might even potentially cut your CPU, this is an extraordinary story, right? But while they were doing the work on this, they started to realize the other impacts that this sort of thing could have. Now, they also introduced backup compression in that version. And in 2008 R2, a lot of people thought the engine didn't change at all there. But one of the things they did, they introduced support for 256 processes, which is important going forward. And they also introduced Unicode compression. That came in that version as well. So don't get the idea that engine had no changes. It really did. But they were realizing as they started doing page compression that when you start looking down columns instead of compressing across rows, the things get really interesting in terms of size. And so they introduced Power Pivot, was the first thing we saw, based on what they call the VertiPack engine. And this was an add-on for Excel that just demonstrated what you could do with this. Now, here, I remember Donald Farmer running around the country and doing sessions and being here at TechEd and showing he had a movie database, had 110 million rows, a whole lot of details of movie hirings. Everybody was looking and going, 110 million rows in Excel, that's awesome. And I thought the same. But the thing that impressed me is it was a 186 meg database. Now that's still, a spreadsheet. Now that's still a big spreadsheet, right? But it was 1.5 bytes per row on average. Now this was double byte data. So on average, less than one character was storing the entire row of data. Now if you can do that, that completely changes how you do processing. And so in 2012, they've applied that to the tabular model. They also applied it to a non-clustered column store index. And the problem with that one is it was an add-on to existing tables. It was very fast, but it made the table read-only. A super important thing in 2014 is that we have now clustered column store indexes that are updatable. And keep an eye out for that in 2014, because that's something that is, again, going to fundamentally change how we do things. But I want to just take you for a quick wander before we get into right into tabular models, what they're doing here. So if you look at row compression, all they were doing is they said, if I have null and zero values, these are really common. We don't want them to occupy any space. If we had string data, they didn't do anything clever with that. And all they did is if I had a char or an n char where I had trailing spaces, they just lopped them off, even though it wasn't really a var char. Numbers, they made smaller if they could. So if we had something like this that was a 4-byte integer, they'd just push it down and say, yeah, we could store that as a byte. And that's all row compression does. Now, I've never seen that cause a problem. I think it's a great thing to have turned on. But then they started realizing we need to do something with text or strings. And so page compression was a multi-step thing, much more work. It starts with row compression, and what they then do is extract prefixes. So if you look at this data I've got sitting here, you often have a degree of commonality down columns. And so the first thing they do is they look at the column, like this first one here, and they say, what's the longest thing that has commonality there? And so they pull Johnny out, stick it up the top, and then what they do in the other places is that where I had John, they say that's the first 4 characters of Johnny. And so they just store a 4. Where the value is Johnny, they just don't store anything. And then you can note Johnson, they said it's the first 4 characters plus son, and then the first character plus act. So once they go into that format, every column starts to have how many characters from the prefix plus the rest of the data. So in the second column, notice it's actually storing 0 plus Turner, which is slightly larger than what the value was, but then the rest of it's really tiny, and so on. Now, once they get to that point, this is the extraction of prefixes, the next thing they do is they look and they go, hang on, that 5 alien thing occurs in a number of places. So the next thing they do is then start building a dictionary, pull all the common values out, stick them up the top, and then just write an entry in there that says what the entry number is in the dictionary. This is what page compression is. And you'll notice if you look at the data now, this is a fraction of the size of what we started with. And this generally is a very, very good story. Now, I'll just quickly show you what effect that has. Can we see? Yep, we're all good. Alrighty, so in AdventureWorks here, if I take reseller sales, that a lot of people know about, they give you a proc called Estimate Data Compression Savings. And if I execute that and say, what do I get if I do row compression? What they do is they dive off into TempDB, use a table sample function, grab a sample of the rows, compress it, and then have a look at the outcome. And so in this case, we've got something with row compression that was 12032 to start with, it's down to 6304, or in fact, yeah, this sort of ballpark. Actually, in fact, this case, 6272. Now, if I look at the value of that, already that's down to 52% of the size of the original data. And that's just row compression. That's doing nothing else in that table. If I look at page compression, where we then do all that other work, this is a little bit more work, but notice dramatically smaller again. And so if we look at the size of this, it's about 23% of the size of the original data. So look, this is a good start. And already makes a big difference in terms of what you can do with the data. But while they were doing the columns and doing the prefix thing, they realized there was a lot more benefit to be gained there. And so X-Velocity in memory analytics is the name the marketing team got loose and changed Vertipack to, so until the marketing team got to that one. But this is the name for this new compression strategy. Now, what they're doing is saying we got good value by compressing individual pages looking down columns. But imagine what we'd get if we did big chunks instead of just small chunks. And so what they do here is they take each of the columns separately, break it into chunks of about a million rows, and then compress that instead. And so we start working with much, much bigger chunks. Now, what's interesting with this is the degree of compression. We routinely see 3 to 10 times without just even general purpose data. I have seen things that are down to 1/150th of the size. I could imagine, depending upon your data, that could even be much higher again. It also means that certain types of operations that were difficult before, like distinct count and so on, that were tricky and multidimensional, suddenly become trivial because what we've actually got are the distinct values, right? Already there. So a lot of those sort of operations suddenly change in their nature as to how fast they are. And so what they're doing is they're taking the data in the table, separate out all the columns separately, they break it into chunks of about a million rows in each case, then they compress each of those segments individually, and then all of the ones that came from the same set of rows form a row group, and that's the thing that gets stored. So this is now a fraction of the size of what it was. And we often see some pretty good numbers out of this. Now, to give you a quick look at what that looks like, in 2014, this is 2014 I'm running here, we have this new column store index. Now, I'll see if I've already got this table here or not. Yep, so I'll grab reseller sales off and push it into another local table. And if I look at the space that's occupied by that, in this case, it's still about that same number we had before, the 12040. If I create a clustered column store index, which uses the same technology as the tabular data model, and say, look, compress that with column store, this is the new style of index, and look at the space on this, then we're down to 1704, right? So this is already something which is 14% of the original size. Now that's just a random fact table that I picked out of the database because it had a number of rows. They've also in 2014 gone further, and if you have data that doesn't change very often at all, they have an even higher level of compression called column store archive. And if I replace the index with that, again, we look at the space occupied, notice it's down further again. And so already this one's down to a tenth of the size of what we started with. Now, what this means, though, to us, is that you've got two ways of doing processing now. So the traditional approach is that we take the data, we organize it as well as we can on the disk, and we build indexes, we do all that, and in the case of analysis services, we aggregate appropriately, we do all the clever stuff. The alternative approach says if we can squash this small enough that it fits in memory, then you just do it by brute force. And things become dramatically simpler as long as it fits. That's the key thing. So if we do try this, what's different? So the first thing is it's a different installation of analysis services. So a single instance doesn't support both models. So we do have a separate analytic model, a different instance of analysis services. You can have both on the one machine, but generally that's a bad idea. From what we've said, you can see that the tabular thing loves memory, right? It just loves memory. That's the whole basis on which it's working. So it's really important that that probably is out all by itself. Now, in terms of the structure of this, when you connect, there's also a change in projects as to when things happen. So, for example, here, if I, in Visual Studio 2012, they have updated the tools for this as well. But if I say, look, File, New Project, and say I want a tabular project, I'll just create that for a sec. Notice it asks for a workspace server. And so the idea here is that it's going to use an instance of analysis services while you're doing work on the project. Now, that's quite different to the multidimensional, because in that case, you're designing a model completely separated from a server that you then just go and deploy. We still do the deploy and things, but this requires one by itself. Now, let me grab one that I've already got here. Okay. Oh, it's already opened. All right. So if I grab this one, in fact, let me close out. Grab him back. Oh, okay. Let me go back in. All right. So what I've got in this project is I've built the same thing in multidimensional and also built it in tabular. And so I've got both types of projects here. Now, so I've got the multidimensional open and the tabular open, but notice if I go to Management Studio and I connect here and connect to Analysis Services, I can connect to the tabular instance. And if we look at the databases that are sitting here, there's currently two databases going on here. So the one is one I've deployed previously, but this one here is the one that's being used as the workspace server while we're doing the work. And so what they do is they take the name of the project, they append the name of the user plus a GUID on the end of it while that's occurring. But so this is a connection separate to the one that I've deployed out there. Now, in terms of the layout of the data, I tried to find things that are similar but maybe implemented a bit differently. So the first are the relationships. Now, in multidimensional models, we can have sort of multi-column relationships. They're not supported in the tabular model. So something to be comfortable with straight up is that that's how it's going to work. I can emulate that using things like calculated columns and so on, which perform at a completely different speed to what they did in the multidimensional one. But I can have multiple relationships between tables, but there's a concept of one that is active and other ones are inactive. Now, the active relationship is that if I say I want to connect across from this table to related data in another table, I don't have to say how if I'm following the active relationship. But if I want to follow another relationship, I have to say how. Now, this is important for role-playing dimensions. So in the case of this one here, where I've got a date table, this is something I'd normally have multiple relationships across. And so role-playing dimensions are a bit of a different story here. So if I look at a typical project here, and I look at a data source view previously, if I look at the relationship, I had the ability to build something with multiple columns at the same time. There's no such thing now. So if you look at the one in this tabular project, on table, I've got manage relationships. These are the active and inactive ones. And if I go to create a relationship, the important thing is once I pick a table, then what I've got from that is just column, right? So there's no concept of sort of multiple columns related here. Now, in terms of the active and inactive, if we look at the graphical view of this, you can see that this date table has sort of multiple relationships across to reseller sales, and if we hover over these, you can sort of see what's joined. So it's order date, due date, ship date, and so on. So this is the concept of having these. But the important thing is that when you go to use these relationships, the issue is, you know, am I doing something? In fact, let me show you an example where I need to specify how I navigate that relationship. So if I go to category here, I could add a calculated column and say, look, this is count AX of related table And then in here, say subcategory or something that it's related to. And then say, what is it I'm counting? Well, I'm counting subcategory, product subcategory key or something. And as I do that, but notice I don't say, I'm not saying joins and things and ons and all that sort of thing. And this has now become part of my model. So if I rename this, this is now number of subcategories, right? But the other thing about this that may not be obvious is I've now calculated and persisted that data directly inside the model, right? So this is different to multidimensional. If I have a calculated column in multidimensional, most of these things are happening when they're calculated on the fly as part of a query. In this case, as I do processing, all the calculations are getting redone at that point. The data's already there, right? So it means the query performance on that sort of thing is actually very, very good in this case. Now, another one that I find with this that's interesting is that I tend to remove an awful lot of what were Snowflake relationships before. And so, for example, if I've got a cinema chain and I've got which group they're part of, and the only reason I joined to that other table was to get the name of the cinema chain, I would probably, and I don't use it for anything else, there's no way I would store that probably as a separate table in the model. Now, I would bring the name of that chain in and have it in amongst the data in the I'd denormalize that. Now, the trick with that, normally you wouldn't do that because that would sort of push the size of it up dramatically. But keep in mind that when we're compressing down columns, the space it takes to repeat that name of that thing all the way down the column is nothing, right? And so this gives us opportunities to simplify stuff that we wouldn't have done before. We also can't do self-joins. There's no concept of that. So we have to design around that. So things like many-to-many become interesting. This was possible in multidimensional, but most people find it slow. It was hard to get it to optimize. It didn't work well with aggregates. The thing I find with many-to-many is often people don't even understand the answer, even though you give it to them. So if I have customers who can be in multiple business categories, and then I have sales by customer, and then somebody says, what are the sales by business category? The question is, what do you mean, you know, if that's the case? And so clients often don't even know what that means when they look at it anyway. But look, in Tabula, you can, there's no direct support for that. You can kind of emulate it in DAX, but once you do, it's super fast. Parent-child is going to happen, right? So we had direct support for that in multidimensional, but a lot of people, for performance reasons, were already trying to naturalize those structures out. In fact, up at CodePlex, there's a parent-child dimension naturalizer that people were using for that. In Tabula, there's no direct support for that. You just naturalize all of your parent-child relationships. So instead of storing something that says, you know, the vice president reports to the president and so on, having a tree structure like that, we literally just build a table that has all the relationships in there. But once you do that, it's exceptionally fast. Whereas in the previous, in multidimensional, it's very slow. As I said, distinct count is something that was tricky before. Now it's super fast doing this sort of thing. And in fact, I'll just quickly show you. We also have that as a measure type in here. You don't have to pre-create it as a measure. But for example, here in reseller sales, I've added sales order count where I wanted the distinct values of that sales order. Now, the DAX expression for that is straightforward. And so I've said, look, sales order count is distinct count of the sales order number. This is actually pretty easy stuff to do, but importantly, it's super fast. Now, another one is hierarchies. Now, we had good support for hierarchies in multidimensional. That's also there now in the tabular model. The only thing you have to be careful of with the tabular model is that you don't specify the attribute relationships yourself. So these are easy to create now, but it's the thing I find about it is it's easy to end up with unnatural hierarchies if you're not careful. Whereas that sort of thing is a lot more obvious, I found, in multidimensional. So if we look at this one, I'll show you an example of that. If I connect up this one here, I've got a query here. If I look at multidimensional, I've got a query where I've said, look, select dimension, unique name, hierarchy name, structure type from hierarchies. You can actually tell if all the hierarchies that are in place are natural or not. And so, and the same query works against tabular models as it does in the multidimensional. Now, if I go back into my model here, and what I do is start to build a hierarchy, that, and if I'm not too careful about it, let me show what happens. So if I take the graphical view, most of this is easiest done in the graphical, and I'll pop this out, and then say, look, I want to create a hierarchy, and let's say calendar. And if I drag down something like calendar quarter, I stick it over the top, and let's say month number or something, or month name, and stick that in. Now, that'll be enough. Now, that seems like it ought to be straightforward, but of course, it's not really what I'm after. And so if I pop that back out, let's deploy that. And that's fine. Now, if I grab, I'll reopen this, and I'll run that query against the tabular model instead. And you'll find, wherever the calendar one is, somewhere deep in here, I will have, oh, in fact, I might have grabbed the other. But the thing is, you'll find that you've actually created an unnatural one. Now, the reason I'm sort of getting at that is that what's going on here is I've picked calendar quarter, but that value is only like a 3. It's not 3 within that particular year. Whereas in the case of the multidimensional model, if I opened up my date dimension, what I had is attribute relationships where I could say how this was all connected up. But importantly, when I look at something like the calendar quarter, I had a property in here on the key columns where I could say to identify this, you actually needed the calendar year and the quarter. And so what happens is that happens automatically under the covers in the multidimensional one and in the tabular one. It's up to you to make sure that that's actually correct, right? I find it's just a little less obvious what's going on there. Now, there's a number of things that are just similar. I think perspectives, I think, are easier to build. Keep in mind, they're not a security thing, but if I want to give someone a view, like a view of the model, and just say, hey, the salespeople normally just see all these things to avoid complexity, that's very, very similar to build in Tabular. The security's pretty straightforward, and what I do like is it's quite easy to create dynamic security using username and lookup value functions. That's actually pretty straightforward. I think as a scripting language, people consider DAX easier to learn, but I wouldn't suggest that it's trivial, right? I mean, they've taken Excel macro language, they've ripped out everything that had something to do with cells, and they've shoved in a whole lot of stuff to do with tables. But an awful lot of people doing this sort of work weren't Excel macro gurus in the first place, right? So getting used to how to do that, even though the learning curve might be sort of smaller, it is something you still have to learn. There's a few good books around on that. I think Marco Russo's one is an excellent book. But what's interesting in that is they spend an entire chapter just on the calculate verb. And so, you know, there are some of these things that do take some effort to get around. Roll up and direct query. Now, in the case of multidimensional, we can specify at each partition, we can say, what's the caching strategy with this? Is it all MOLAP? Is it ROLAP and so on? That's not the case in Tabular. So we have direct query, but it applies to the entire model, not to the individual partitions within there. So that's a big choice you're making. The other thing is if you choose to have direct query, it only works with DAX queries, not with MDX queries. And DAX has become a query language as well. The data types, I think, are similar, but richer, I think, in the tabular model. And KPIs are probably easier to build in the tabular model, but again, they don't have the trend. So just quickly show you this. Let's have a look in here where I've got that model. Let's pop back out to the other view. And so if I look across at, say, reseller sales, I had that measure that I'd built here before. So if all I do for these is I right-click and say create KPI. This is actually quite smooth, and so what it does is I can say, look, I want to compare that to some other measure, or I want to compare it to some absolute value, and then you can specify, if it's an absolute value or something, you can then start breaking down, you know, what's the relationship here, and you know, what's the number of cutoffs, and where do I want them, and icons and so on. It's very graphical, very, very simple to do. That's actually a very good story. Also on model, as I said, some of the things in here like perspectives, if I look at a perspective, it's just new perspective, tick off the stuff you want. You know, many of these things are very, very simple to do in the tabular model. All right, so what's different? And so we've looked at the things that are pretty much the same, but they're implemented in different ways. There are things that are added or missing, though. So first up, some of the things that I think are improvements. So the first is I can process dimensions without having to process the associated measure groups. That's a huge thing for a lot of places. You can also partition dimensions, where you could only do that with facts in multidimensional. Now, a lot of people would think, well, why would I do that? But I've seen things where, for example, we have a customer's dimension and it's broken down by state and we receive state-based data, you can then go and sort of process just that partition of the data. They also added a set of reporting properties. Now, what this is about is that you'll see a lot of demonstrations where people have client tools and they do things like drag a table out and just suddenly a certain set of columns appears and so on. And you think, well, hang on, how did that happen, right? And so what it is those sort of properties are also part of the model. So, for example, if I take product here and I look at the properties, I've got a bunch of reporting properties. Now, first up is default field set. And so when I open this up, this says, hey, if somebody just drags this out, here's my choice of what the columns are that should just magically appear on the screen. So there's nothing like this by comparison in multidimensional. So this is a richness that's just there for that. Now, another thing that's sort of interesting with that is, let me grab, you'll see examples where people pull up a card. And so let me find, actually I might have it in that project. In fact, I think I pushed it right in here in Solution Explorer. So in things like PowerView, you'll see they have these sort of visualizations that are very, very rich. And you say, well, hang on, like, how did it know, if you just say, show me that table, I want to see that as a set of cards, like, how did it know, you know, which thing that is? You know, and things like, how did it know how to format these things, and like, what columns should appear and so on? Again, that stuff lives as part of this model. And so if we look at the other properties here, there's things like table behavior, and we drill into table behavior, it's things like, how do I identify a particular row and which things need to be kept unique? And if there's a label, you know, where do I get that from? I got my product name. And if I need to show a picture, you know, the large photo is the thing that'll be used to generate thumbnails and so on. These are properties that are part of this model. And of course, you don't have to set all this sort of stuff, but it makes a world of difference to someone who's then using the model later. So then that's all great. What's the downside? All right. So first up, translations aren't present. So it's possible in multidimensional to say, here are my default labels, but if somebody's connected with a different regional setting or different language, what do I want to show instead? And so there's options there to do that. Now, we don't have that, right? That's not part of it. Named sets, you need to sort of emulate that a bit in DAX, but again, there's no concept of having a built-in what do I mean by top 10 customers directly in the model. What I would have to do is create that as a set of calculated stuff that lives perhaps in a different table in the model, but a lot of that would be worked out at process time. You don't have actions. So actions in multidimensional mean I can right-click a value and maybe go to the website for that, or things like that. All you have is basic drill through there. Custom assemblies, you don't get to write VBA code and say, hey, I'm going to go off and call these SEP. What you do do instead is, of course, write DAX for doing this. You don't have MDX scripting. So if you have a whole lot of existing MDX, that isn't going to go inside there, right? Query, yes, but the inbuilt scripting, no. Custom rollups is another one. So if I say, look, when I add up this column, I want to specify the operator for how to, is this added or deleted or and so on or subtracted. I don't get to do that. I have to build that into my model. Now, all it usually means is I have to build another column that says this is the one that gets added up rather than the original, you know, when you do these calculations or build the measure. Write back. Again, you have to implement that stuff. It's not part of the model. And if you want to, instead of a strategy on how missing keys work, if you just leave it default, all that happens is it just maps all of the values to a single missing key value. That's it. But it's still, I mean, that's okay. But look, in many cases, what I find in the case of things that were done in MDX script, in many cases, you can do that via ETL scripting. And that actually turns out to be a good story. I mean, it's a little bit more work in ETL. As I said, it's often a better way to do it. And it ends up being a lot faster anyway. In fact, it reminds me, I'll just show you. I had a thing from one of my mates, Jamie Thompson, who many of you may have come across, who writes a lot on ETL, and he was saying he got a query from his bank. They addressed him as Unknown Thompson and asked him what he thought of their service and could he rate it from 10 to 0. So, of course, he did the obvious thing and rated it as minus 1. So it's kind of neat. I'd love to know what that happened in their system. But look, there's plenty of info around on how to do a lot of this ETL stuff. And so, look, what should I do? So, look, I think you get the question that says, should I take my existing projects and migrate them? I don't think so, right? If you've got large, complicated projects, it's not going to be a great idea to do that again. Migration is not simple, right, in doing this. It's much easier and faster to build stuff from scratch, no argument. But, you know, re-implementing stuff that you've already done a lot of work on, that's something you need to think long and hard about as to whether that would pay the right benefit. However, if you have something that would lend itself, data-wise, to have a bigger, improved performance story, and you are suffering performance problems, that's a different story, right? I mean, that could well push it that way. Existing MDX knowledge is still a good thing. The models, a tabular model, responds to MDX as well as to DAX. But I think if you're doing new projects, a good example would be to get some experience using Power Pivot in Excel, just to play around and start to get your head around, how do I do this stuff? And that's a very easy, low-impact way to start to learn this stuff. And I see it down the track as a bit like maybe C# and C++ as languages today. You could choose to write all your projects in C++. You could do that, but nobody would. Because the thing is, the amount of work you would do to do that just doesn't justify it. So you would end up writing most of your projects in C# and then doing just the tricky ones in C++. And I think the same sort of thing is going to apply here, is that I think your default should probably be considered that you're going to try and do these things in tabular. And my guess is that maybe 80 or 90% of the projects will just do that fine. What's impressive is usually how quickly these projects come together. I've been on sites recently where they've spent years doing multidimensional projects, and they have spun up new tabular ones within months, and people are stunned at the outcome. So this is not something I sort of suggest lightly. I think you really need to think, are there many, many projects? Now, there are some where you could potentially, based on things we've talked about, run into a brick wall, but you need to make that assessment, and I think you'll find it's a large number of projects that this will work fine for. Another question is, do I still need some sort of dimensional model under this? I get really nervous when I see sessions and they just say, just layer this over the top of your existing transactional systems and things. And look, you still probably need a decent data model underneath it, right? It's all very well to say, you know, bring all this stuff in, and but if the underlying data model is a mess, you've still got a mess, right? I mean, you might have a more quickly built and prettier mess, but it's still a mess, right? So you still have to do the basic sort of ETL work and so on to get a really good outcome. Because the dimensional models give you sort of clarity, they consolidate data from a whole lot of different systems, and things like versioning of data and so on. Often the data warehouse has information which simply doesn't exist in the source systems anymore. Now, in terms of hardware implications, this changes things significantly. So memory and CPU, but mostly memory, becomes such a big issue. Now, there is a white paper I've mentioned here. Now, it's called Hardware Sizing, a Tabular Solution. As a reviewer on this, it was sort of published within the last few months. I'd suggest grab that and read it if you're starting to head down this path in production systems. Some of the suggestions they have there as to what size you might start with. At first, you might look and go, wow, that's a lot of memory. But they are trying to sort of push you towards where things are heading. Another one, if you don't have the things to get and work with while trying to do this, Azure is a nice spot to get and try this sort of stuff. What I quite like is that up at Azure, the virtual machines, there are templates in the gallery there that have pre-installed SQL Server 2014 or 2012 on various versions of the server operating system, pre-installed. You can sort of pop up there. In many cases, there are free trials. You can go up there, spin up a virtual machine. 10 minutes later, you've got a fully installed thing sitting there running, you know, whatever. That's a really, really good way to learn to do it. Now, what I do like is they have a competition at the moment. So if before the end of the month, if you have an MSDN subscription and you activate your Azure benefits, this adds about a couple of $100 a month of Azure credits onto your based on your MSDN subscription. What I like, though, is until the end of the month, they said they're going to give somebody who does that an Aston Martin, and I thought, kind of cool. So I would desperately love to see them ship that to Australia, right? Rather than have it just go somewhere in the US. And I also, when I read the rules on the thing, it says something like they'd also pay a whole bunch of taxes potentially against it as well. But again, there's limits and stuff. Read the actual rules that are up on the site. If you go to my blog, so just Greg Low, L-O-W, and blog, you'll find I've got links there that take you right to the pages for this stuff. I'd encourage you, if nothing else, if you have an MSDN subscription, just activate it so that you've got the credits anyway. But as I said, a lot of this stuff, there's free options where you can go and try it. And so, related content-wise, there's a number of sessions that I think are sort of related to this coming up later in the week. In particular, Peter Myers has got a data mining session, which, of course, this is another thing that's different in that the multidimensional models are still the ones with the data mining. And so if you're wondering, is data mining something for me, then go along and have a look at Peter's session. Denny's got a session having a look at some of the biggest Azure projects in the world. Many of those are data warehouse related. And building order from chaos, again, another one looking at unstructured data. In my own case, tomorrow morning, if you haven't played around with Azure much, I've got a session for SQL DBAs that just takes you through all of the core things I think are important to know about how you might use things in Azure and what's available today in terms of data. And look, for myself, I'll be down at the tables outside the area or in the community area, either one, in the demo area, pretty much the rest of the event. So, thanks for that, folks. And if you have questions, I've put contact details there. Please just come and see. Don't be a stranger. And as I said, pop down and I'll be around as long as you need for the rest of the time. I've put contact details there. I thank you very much for choosing to come along this morning. Thanks.